This is 88.9 FM, Neighborhood Public Radio. My name is Zephyr, and you're listening to Frank Prattle. I'm live here with an extra special guest today, and tucked away in a secret apartment in the Tenderloin. So this is William Ian Jones, famous filmmaker, currently up in San Francisco from Los Angeles. Hi, William.
Hello.
Anyway, you were saying about your screenings coming up.
Yeah, I'm here for a screening at the Pacifica Film... Oh, boy. The moment it gets formal, I start screwing up. I'm here for a screening at the Pacific Film Archive in Berkeley on Tuesday the 20th at 7:30 p.m.
Great. What are you going to be showing?
I'm showing three works. The longest, the main attraction, is called V.O., and it's accompanied by two shorts, film montages for Peter Rohr, and more British sounds.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about V.O.
V.O. was the product of my recombining scenes from a massive collection I have of VHS bootlegs. VHS is a form which is dying away.
Oh, sad to say.
Yeah, but you know, many of us who are fetishists have huge collections of VHS tapes, and I decided to make use of mine before the form completely died.
Right.
And I have, my collection is roughly divided in half. Gay porno is one half, and then the other half is European art films that film critics and programmers who are friends of mine have traded me for, movies that I love dearly that are not distributed in the United States. And so I decided to use the sound and the subtitles of the dialogue from the European art films and combine them with scenes from gay porno. The scenes I use from the pornos are not sexually explicit. They're the transitional scenes, the marginal scenes, dialogue sequences, establishing shots. And they're really quite fascinating. They provide a glimpse of what a certain type of gay life was like at a certain moment in history, at a moment which has passed for a lot of reasons. And It's a funny thing, you know, these pornographers didn't set out to make documentaries.
Right.
But they ended up documenting something, I think, extremely interesting. So I used the visuals from them with this dialogue, which is related thematically, perhaps, to the material you see. But actually, it was a very strict formalist mashup procedure. I would put scenes together if they were of the same length. So I logged extensively these scenes that I was interested in, and I simply matched them up when they were the same length. So I would have a couple of minutes, like let's say 1 minute and 53 seconds,
right,
of a rare interview with Jean Genet would be matched with 1 minute and 53 seconds of a Joe Gage porno. And it's the sort of thing that you think might not work at all, but I went into the studio and tried it out. I had no idea if it would work.
Right.
And I went into the editing studio and you know, some scenes didn't work at all, but other scenes worked really brilliantly. In fact, it was, some of them worked so well, I wondered if the filmmakers had each other's work in mind when they made their stuff.
Huh.
I'm very fond of a movie called The Death of Maria Malibran by Werner Schroeder. And I paired it with a movie that was shot in San Francisco called Nights in Black Leather by Peter Berlin. And it was the strangest thing. I thought I would just pair up a small section of those movies, but I ended up rolling it out, and in fact, 7 minutes of those two movies fit perfectly together.
Huh.
And they were made around the same time, so I do wonder if somehow these people were on the same wavelength. But yeah, so that was my procedure. It's a strict formalist mashup.
Huh. How much would you say your own practice then is it kind of influenced by this, like this DJ culture that has really arisen not only, you know, in the United States but everywhere?
This is the first manifestation of that in my work. I made a long documentary that was shown in San Francisco and has been released on DVD called Is It Really So Strange?
Right.
And it concerns the subculture of Morrissey and Smiths fans in Southern California, most of whom are Latino.
Right.
And I interviewed people in their bedrooms. It was a very sort of intimate project, but it took a lot out of me. And I completed it in 2004. And I decided my next project would be something that I didn't spend quite so much time and energy on.
How long did you spend on Is It Really So Strange?
It was about 3 years in the making.
And I have to ask, I mean, for the listening audience, William actually went undercover, would you say? Or would you... undercover, I wouldn't guess, would be the right word. I would say you assimilated. You became...
Well... I always was a fan.
Right. But there's a difference, no?
But the thing I discovered, the thing I discovered is it wasn't enough just to be a nice guy hoping that people would talk to me. What I had to do is get a pompadour.
Right.
Yeah, the men in the scene, many of them have really beautiful hairdos.
Gorgeous. There's one boy in particular who defines himself as a greaser, I think.
Oh, yeah, he's a greaser.
And his has got to be 5 inches, would be my guess. 4 to 5 inches high.
Yeah.
Of this rolling pompadour wave off the top of his head.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it... So as soon as I got a pompadour, people were much more likely to talk to me. And I wore a pompadour for about a year. I would wear it at work, I would wear it around, it was just my hairdo. And this, you know, the fact that I was willing to do this, I think that proved that I was bona fide. It wasn't just superficiality, you know, oh, he looks like that, so we can talk to him. You have to live your life in a certain way if you have a really outrageous hairdo.
Right.
You spend an hour every morning doing your hair, and that's a sacrifice.
Is that an hour?
It was an hour, yeah.
But it's worth it, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, take his word for it. Although you can see the movie on DVD now, so you can see if it's really worth it. One of the scenes involves me getting a pompadour from one of the interview subjects.
Yes, that's one of my personal favorite scenes out of it.
It's the only time I appear in my own work.
There you go.
Really, that project took a lot out of me. It was long and expensive and tiring, and I thought I wanted to do something that was a complete change of pace.
Right.
And so I made material that was appropriated. I also have a job in the adult video industry.
Okay. What, and you know, when you say job, I mean, there are many jobs in the adult video industry. What would your job be?
I do not appear on camera
regularly,
but I do produce cheap gay porno comps. These compilations that are 4 hours long, collected scenes from old gay porno. I assemble these, I think up the titles, and I'm the liaison with the art department to get the packaging done. And so, you know, they're on the shelves of your local adult video store. And that's one of the things I do for a living. I decided that there was so much of interest in this material that I wanted to do something with it. The sex scenes lost their thrill.
Yeah,
quite quickly.
When you say porno in America, especially, you know, being the repressed lot that we are, when the word porno is uttered, you know, half the room gets uptight and the other half is like, "What do you say?"
It's true.
what were your experiences? Obviously, like working very closely in the porn industry.
I got very burned out seeing explicit sex scenes. They do lose their charm fairly quickly. The thing that changes from scene to scene and from movie to movie is the setting or the individual faces of the men. And they can be quite fascinating. You know, the way people looked in 1984 is very different than the way they look now. The way Los Angeles looked in the 70s is very different than it looks now. And if you go further back, you know, there are these sort of crazy hippie types that one hardly sees anymore, and one almost never sees in a gay bar.
Right.
And so it was a great way of preserving what I consider to be most important about this material. Although clearly that's not its main commercial use. Part of what's at stake for me is a kind of diversion. You know, I'm taking something which is considered to be of marginal interest by the industry. It's not the main point. And I'm preserving it and giving it another context and reinventing it, in
right.
a sense.
Right.
And diverting something which normally people would fast forward through.
Right.
But it's actually quite precious in a way.
And how much of that, I mean, have you gotten any flack or criticism for it being kind of almost a tease that way? Or, I mean, are there people who, you know, teasing's the whole point? That's what they're after.
I don't look at it that way. The way I see it is that I'm preserving and contextualizing the non-sexual parts of these videos and films. What a lot of people say is, oh, you just cut out the sex. And, you know, that's, I suppose, a semantic argument that has no end.
Right.
It really depends on your expectations coming to the project. I've had a number of people criticize the work for not being explicitly sexual. But my argument is always, if that's what you want to see, just go to the adult video store and buy my mainstream product. Yeah, buy the old...
It's a win-win.
Yeah, exactly. And I was interested in highlighting something else about the material, going
right.
against the grain of the material.
And
I think that is really the place where criticism or theory or history can begin. You have to, in some sense, you have to go against the grain of the material in order to appreciate it properly. Although clearly, you know, sexual arousal is important too.
Right.
But as I say, it's something you can buy in the local adult video store, and I'm hoping to get something that's not quite that. The stuff that you tend to ignore when you're after your thrill.
Before and after.
But, I'm a little disappointed because the people at the PFA called them the anticlimactic scenes.
Really?
Of the videos, and I don't consider them anticlimactic at all. They're quite fascinating in and of themselves. People who are not particularly interested in cinema, people who are just, you know, I guess they're at it. They're at the screening to see sex. They're disappointed. And so I have found that the main audience for VO tends to be cinephiles, tends to be people who are really interested in seeing movies or who are
right.
fetishists of movies, and not people who are fetishists of porno, exactly.
Right.
Oh, I should explain VO. It can mean voiceover, which is appropriate for the piece. But my intention with it was to allude to version originale. When you see a movie in Europe and it's in its original language with subtitles, it's in VO, version originale, the original version.
Huh.
And so it's a kind of tribute to this sort of film culture of going to the movie houses that show subtitled movies, not dubbed ones.
Right, which is horrendous.
But, you know, the mass market of movies is dubbed.
Oh.
Some countries more than others, but you know, dubbing is kind of the standard for a lot of people.
I spent about a year in Brazil, and every movie that I saw there was dubbed. And
right.
It just takes a beautiful movie and turns it into schlock, like instantaneously.
And you know, it's a tribute, among other things, to the kind of film culture of people going to movie houses where they show things in the original version.
Right.
And it's a little subtle. A lot of people don't get it. But if you, the moment you crack open a movie guide in Paris, you see VO over and over and over again.
One question I had for you, though, is you talked about the scenes that, you know, the pre and after scenes in pornos and your fascination with those. What were some of the trends specific things that kept reoccurring over and over again? What did you love about them? Describe them a little bit.
Well, as I say, the appearance of people and the appearance of urban environments they've changed.
Right.
And so I'm fascinated with how people used to look, with what sort of
pompadours in specifically?
Not necessarily in VO.
Did you have any crossover?
No, not really. That was one of the reasons I made this work, is to do something that was a real departure
right,
from what
sorry,
I'd done before.
No.
And in fact, I feel as though I lead a double life. There are people who only know, is it really so strange?
Right.
And then there are people who know about this other aspect of my life and my production, which is curious, but that's, you know, the world we live in. There are venues for a certain kind of work, and then there are venues for other works. And,
right.
And you know, Is It Really So Strange didn't get shown at the PFA, but it did get released on DVD. And then these current works are being shown in, you know, fairly rarefied cultural environments.
Right.
There is more of an art project. I'm sorry, what was the question? Oh, yeah, what interests me. Well,
what that, and also like some of the themes that you
yeah.
noticed coming up over and over.
Well, something that really fascinated me about this material, much of it was done years before people knew what AIDS was. And yet, there is still an interest in death, almost an obsessive quality to this material. There's something very dark about it. And it wasn't something I made up or imposed upon the material in any strict sense. It was something I found in the material and brought out. And that to me was completely fascinating. It was a really stunning discovery that a lot of old gay pornos from the 70s, they're fun, they're celebratory, they're sexy, but they're also rather dark. And there's an obsessive quality to them that it can't really be repeated. And you know, it's a curious thing. People who are, you know, fucking their brains out, but also obsessed with death.
Right.
And to me, it's a very interesting discovery. It leads to something quite disturbing. And the piece is really rather dark and disturbing.
Right. How much would you say that you, in you know, your viewing habits, are drawn really to the macabre and the darker side of life?
Well, clearly, an interesting movie has to be fairly complex,
right?
In order to have staying power. If you really just watch something and consume it, and you're done with it, nothing stays with you. I mean, there are these movies now out now. I feel as though they erase themselves from your head as soon as you see them. There can't be anything that troubles your reading of the movie. There can't be anything peculiar or idiosyncratic. There can't be anything that stays with you in that kind of movie. Once they've gotten your ticket money, they're done with you. And I'm obviously I'm interested in cinema, so I'm interested in things that are perhaps a little perverse, a little darker, a little stranger. We've got to stop that noise,
yeah,
don't we?
On.
Yeah, maybe. This place was a symphony of strange noises while I was trying to sleep here last night. But you know, I think that is what it is to be a cinema fetishist, is to be attracted to something a little bit peculiar or a little bit outside the realm of normal consumption. There are all sorts of different ways to watch a movie. And now that DVD has become a standard for people watching things at home, you can get these lovely still frames, and you can run things forward and backward, and it's beautiful to look at. And it has encouraged, it has facilitated this fetishistic view of the movies. It has enabled people to become what they could only be for fleeting moments when films were just projected in movie theaters. And I think that ultimately this kind of fetishism is quite dark. You know, it is about a kind of solitary pleasure with something that you can't get out of your mind, that you're obsessed with, or that gives you a kind of pleasure, but at the same time is a bit painful as well.
Right. I know that for myself along those lines. Almost, I mean, with the advent of the DVD and the, you know, bonus material and, you know, trailers in addition to, you know, rare interviews and, you know, unused footage and stuff like that, that I get almost more obsessed with that material.
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems to almost bridge that gap between these are the actors and it's like I'm on set.
Mm-hmm.
This could have been me, you know. What are your feelings on that kind of extra material and what that's turned movies into? I mean, in your own work, do you offer that? Is It Really So Strange? You know, on the DVD, is there extra?
There wasn't a lot of extra for Is It Really So Strange. I was satisfied enough with the cut of the movie that I could really only think of a couple of minutes of extra stuff I would want to put on it, and it just seemed a little too skimpy to qualify as an extra. Whatever alternate version of me you're interested in seeing is generally embodied on my website.
Right.
My website is williamejones.com, and you can go there and see all sorts of extra stuff. And it's a website I'm constantly tweaking and updating, so I'm constantly revising this autobiography. When it comes to DVDs that are commercially available, sometimes the extras are very interesting and very informative. That tends to be the case more with historical films. Archivists have done research about the films and have perhaps the advantage of historical distance. For contemporary films, it just tends to be more promotion. Yet another instance for people to say how much they love the movie. If I have to hear an actor one more time say how much he loves working with director X, I really don't know if I'm going to be able to cope. That stuff is of very little interest to me. But on the other hand, sometimes some of these extras can be quite wonderful. John Waters' films always have commentaries from him, and it's kind of like sitting around with your crazy old gay uncle watching some movie and him making these comments, and they're really quite fun. So it really all depends, but you know, the more blatantly self-promoting of the extras are of very little interest to me. But I think that perhaps this form is in its infancy, that, you know, there is somewhere in this the possibility of a kind of meta cinema.
Right.
And that is actually quite promising.
When you say
I wonder though, the meta cinema may not be commercially viable. It may not be approved by the corporations that make the movies and put on DVDs. I think it's the sort of thing that flourishes more on YouTube.
Right. So obviously you know YouTube.
Oh, of course.
For the listeners out there, if you haven't seen YouTube, which I've been surprised, there have been some people who haven't.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, people come up and ask me, what is YouTube? It's at youtube.com on the internet, and it might be probably the best website out now.
It's certainly an interesting one.
Yeah.
It is a cultural touchstone. I think it's less than a year old.
Is it?
It may have had its first anniversary recently, but it's very new.
Yeah, definitely new.
And I knew something was happening when my students started telling me about YouTube. I teach at art schools in Southern California. And I would show movies in my classes. And every so often I would show something and somebody in the class would say, oh, I've seen that already on YouTube. And so, you know, it is a kind of massive, formless archive of short films, bootlegged films. But there are other people who use YouTube as a form for exposing their art. They make mashups, they make re-edited versions of movies, and they post them. And so in the midst of this massive, undifferentiated group of stuff, I mean, it's really, most of it is not terribly interesting. Most of it is in fact derivative of the most pathetic mass culture. But every so often you see this thing which is just compelling.
I would say it's akin to going to a huge thrift store where, you know, 98% of it is just this horrible rubbish crap that's just strewn about everywhere. But then you get that one record or that one book that you've been looking for 15 years. You're like, Jesus Christ!
Yeah, except in some cases it's a book that's been curiously attached to a door handle or reconfigured into a lamp. That's the thing that really is quite special about YouTube, because these people put on their own versions of movies or of scenes from movies. And it's almost like going into the thrift store and finding some extraordinary piece of folk art.
Right.
And that to me is kind of fascinating. I don't know how long that's going to last.
Well,
or if the environment is going to continue, because there are so many intellectual property concerns, which, you know, I'm no corporate lawyer, but it is something that people are going to have to cope with.
Well, one question that I had for you is, I mean, content-wise, and this might not be a problem for you or might be. I know that YouTube has combers, they call them, who go through all the material, and whatever they deem inappropriate, they just delete it.
Mm-hmm.
And they delete your account, too.
Yeah.
How do you think that influences kind of this new, you know, meta form of cinema?
I think that if the combers get powerful enough, if their net is cast wide enough and they become strict enough in their purview, then it could kill the form in that context.
Right.
But the culture of the internet is so wide and so diverse that I don't think it's possible to go back to the moment when intellectual property was firmly in the hands of corporate entities. Pandora's box has been opened.
Right.
And even if YouTube goes out of business, there will be replacements within hours. And I don't think that it's the sort of cultural form that can be stopped. I don't actually post anything on YouTube.
Okay.
I am more interested in the concentrated attention that people give things in movie theaters. I am interested in criticism. I am interested in discussion. I want my work to get reviewed, and I want people to see it, and I'm available for questions afterwards, and I have no problem doing Q&As. I think they can be quite useful and quite interesting. I find them mostly insufferable, so I try extra hard to make mine interesting to people. I figure this is their one chance to see me, the guy who made it.
Right.
I better make the moment worthwhile. And that kind of community in a physical sense, in an immediate sense, is not really possible on the internet. And, I mean, this has been said a million times, but it is true. And I find the criticism, the level of discourse on YouTube is pretty low. And I can't... It's a funny thing. New media are taking over. The internet is taking over in a way. But consistently, I have found that the most interesting and literate reviews I've gotten have been in traditional print media.
Right.
And the most interesting comments I've heard have come from public screenings. And these rituals and these forms are not going to go away. And they're the forms that I prefer. And maybe that's because I'm an old fogey, I don't know. But I thus far, even though I've seen interesting work posted on the internet, I've seen very little interesting criticism and discussion. I think there's hope. But YouTube is not the site of fascinating discourse, certainly.
Well, I mean, this kind of dovetails into another question that I think a lot of people, you know, can answer in various ways in their own life, you know, especially listeners at home. It's something I've been wrestling with is how much time in your daily life do you actually spend on the computer?
Mm-hmm.
And you being a filmmaker, do you use software editing stuff, you know, Final Cut, Avid, what?
I am exposing myself as something of an old fogey. I use the computer as little as possible.
Okay.
Partly it's a physical thing. I have concerns for my eyes and for my wrists and my hands. I don't want to ruin myself physically because I'm at the computer all the time.
Right.
And I think, you know, people who have computers in the workplace are probably, you know, they're setting themselves up for long-term disabilities if they don't watch it. And if their employers are not sufficiently vigilant. So I don't spend a lot of time on the computer. I write my scripts longhand.
Do you?
Yes, I use a pad and pen.
What
just the first draft either, subsequent drafts as well. What?
Do you have a particular pad, particular pen? Do you have a ritual? Or is
I do, actually. The pad is sitting over there in that bag.
All right.
And, you know,
white line, college rule?
Yes, you know. So I'm really a traditionalist in a way. Most of the work done on VO and on the other projects I did at around the same time was done with VHS tapes and a VCR at home, making very careful notes. And once I made the notes, I transferred them to index cards. this is, I mean, you know, for those of you out there who are interested in making a film on the cheap, absolutely basic, cheap technology will help you immeasurably. There are many documentary filmmakers who do paper edits. They really spend their time shuffling around index cards.
Right.
If you are on a Final Cut Pro system, for instance, and you have lots of material, you can be overwhelmed by that material. and not make any real decisions, or you can keep trying things out forever and it doesn't lead anywhere. The really old-fashioned way of making a documentary film is to do a paper edit, to have the dialogue from all the scenes you shot transcribed, to have those transcriptions cut into little pieces and arranged by theme, by source tape, and put them on, you know, little index cards. And I did it with Is It Really So Strange? I spent a month doing a paper edit before I ever touched a computer. I had 200 index cards at the beginning of the month. And every day I would go through them. I would arrange them in different orders. I would lay them out on the bed and look at them all. I would eliminate some. I would put them in different orders. It was almost like playing solitaire for a month. At the end of the month, I had 75 index cards, down from 200. And those 75 index cards were what I took into the editing room. And I had them arranged in an order. And my editor I worked with, she lined up all the scenes one by one. And at the end of the 75 cards, we had a 95-minute cut. And I was euphoric because it was the first moment when I realized I had a movie.
Huh.
And I changed it considerably in the editing room. But there is really something deeply satisfying about, you know, playing solitaire for a month, and then at the end of it, you realize you have a movie.
Yes.
And the technique of VO is very similar. I would have these pairs of index cards. I'd have on the left, there'd be a gay porno scene. That was the visuals. And on the right, there'd be the...
Did you draw it out, or did you take, a picture?
I drew, I wrote, I didn't do pictures, but I did, snippets of dialogue.
Right.
And it was all very carefully logged. And I would shuffle the various cards and put them together in various combinations. And when I found two scenes that went together, I thought I would tape them together. So I had these oblong pairs of index cards. And I took those into the editing room. And that was the beginning of VO. So, and in fact, all of my editing is done by others. The physical work of the editing. I'm not interested in fixing a computer crash at 2 o'clock in the morning because
right.
Final Cut Pro has lost it.
Right.
So I work with editors. They do the physical execution of the work. And I have a couple of editors I really trust, and I'm very happy to work with them. I'm also very happy not to, be concerned with technical concerns. The piece VO, as well as the other pieces I'm showing, they have almost as much to do with conceptual art as they have to do with the world of computers and nonlinear editing. That just happens to be the form in which they are realized.
Right.
And in fact, if I can talk about another one of the pieces, Film Montages for Peter Rohr,
which is also screening
at the
Berkeley,
PFA,
on Tuesday.
On Tuesday. Peter Rohr was a really wonderful artist. He died in 1968, and he died young. He died at age 24. His guiding principle in all of his works was strict mechanical repetition. Simply put, he saw Warhol's work, he saw Saul Lewitt's work, and he decided to take it at its word and make repetition the guiding principle of his work, but not human repetition, not messy repetition, but strict repetition of photographic images, mostly. But he made some films. He wasn't a filmmaker. He had other people execute his films. But the concept was that he took identical moments from advertising films and repeated them. So one of his films consists almost entirely of a woman flipping her hair. from a shampoo commercial. There are other films he did that are views of skyscrapers and automobiles and headlights on the freeway. But, you know, small snippets, let's say 2 seconds or
from
3 seconds,
different
repeated
sources.
As a loop. And he would have one loop, and then he would go on to another loop, and then another.
The same material, though.
Essentially, right. Yeah. And it was the construction of loops. But this was back when there were 16 millimeter prints of advertisements. So it was real physical work for
right.
the guy to execute them. You know, he had to get 16 identical prints of a commercial and cut them up.
Wow.
Or 8 identical prints or 4 identical prints, however many repetitions he was interested in doing. I had the luxury of a non-linear editing system, so I got to repeat things as much as I wanted.
You were like, open Apple, see.
But the editor I worked with, one of his big interests is music editing. So we did a kind of musical composition, which had a visual component as well. And I took these short sequences from gay porno films. But I didn't shift the sound. It was image and sound together.
Right.
So they both had to make a loop. It had to be an interesting loop visually
and
in terms of its
yeah,
sound.
Right.
And that was, you know, that strict parameter meant that there were very few scenes I could actually use. But I did manage to get together this 11-minute video of various loops, and it progresses like a musical composition. First it's in 4, and then it's in 6, and then it's in 8. And it's I think quite an attractive thing to look at. The title doesn't reveal that it has anything to do with gay porn, but it is strictly based upon the model developed by Peter Rohr. I put his name in the title because I think he's a wonderful artist, but Americans hardly know about him at all.
Right.
He really only had shows in Germany. And I got to see his work at an exhibition at the Lannan Foundation in Santa Monica years ago, but I never forgot it. I thought, oh, it would be interesting to make this tribute. So yeah, that's one of the pieces showing at the PFA as well.
Well, speaking of which, how many pieces have you made?
Oh, a few. I've been making movies since... Oh, it's been almost 20 years I've been making movies. I started out making long 16mm films, more or less traditional experimental films or experimental documentaries. In 1991, I completed a movie called Massillon. And then the second movie I did was called Finished. And they were, you know, traditional 16mm movies. And then I started making things in video. And I had a kind of nostalgia for the photographic, so it was a difficult transition for me. But I ended up making 7 works. I ended up making 7 works in 2006.
7?
Yeah. How that
this
was
last year?
I'm not really sure how that happened. I was a busy guy. I had 4 jobs, 3 teaching jobs and a porno job, and I made 7 works in 1 year. And I lived through it.
Congrats.
Thanks.
And
you'll see 3 of them at the PFA.
Right.
Yeah.
You're not dead.
I'm not dead. No, far from it. And it was a really, you know, it was fun. It was tiring, but it was fun. And now I'm, you know, making sure they get out there in the world, these works. I hope to be making something in the next year or so.
Yeah, so what do you have rattling around upstairs? What any ideas? Anything you care to share?
I have so many ideas that I can't make. It's what should I pull out of a hat for you? One of the things that interests me is to make a film adaptation of The Anatomy of Melancholy. We're talking about all this new technology, but this is quite old. The Anatomy of Melancholy was written in the 17th century by Robert Burton, and he was at Oxford, and he was there in the generation after the main collection of the Bodleian Library was assembled. So his work is, in a sense, the product of the modern library, the earliest manifestation of it. He could not do his work without a library. He decided that he would assemble and collate every instance of melancholy in the entire literary corpus of the classical world.
My God.
And so it was this immense project. He went through the texts of the ancients and accumulated all of this material about melancholy, its causes, its cures. The first edition was in 1621, and he kept revising it until he died in 1640. It went through six editions, the sixth being published right after his death. And it was what he devoted his life to. And I think it might be possible somehow for me to make a movie version of a slender portion of it. It's a 1,200-page book. It's something like 450,000 words. But
so
I've estimated in my structural way that I can adapt approximately 1% of the text. And I've assembled a script of 1% of the text. But with me, you know, it's never easy. The next question is, well, what am I going to do to accompany these images with, or these texts with images?
Right.
And my intuition is that what will accompany them is images of my hometown, Los Angeles, seen from the point of view of a pedestrian. I don't have a car, and I get around Los Angeles on public transportation.
Really? Do tell.
Yes.
I've heard that's harrowing and dangerous at best.
How could it possibly be dangerous? I think the dangers of Los Angeles are grossly exaggerated by the media.
Really?
For motives that I hesitate to think about. No, it's possible. I had a car.
Right.
But it was destroyed in a hit-and-run accident, and I decided not to replace it. And just to see what my life would be like. And thus far, it's been almost 2 years. The second anniversary will be in April. I've lived without a car in Los Angeles. I live a very different kind of life than I lived before. But maybe not that different, because when I had a car, I was always obsessed with avoiding traffic.
Right.
I arranged my whole life so I would avoid traffic. Which is possible, but you lead a very different kind of life.
Nocturnal.
Perhaps. I mean, you know, if you have teaching jobs or you work from home, you can have a different schedule than most people.
Right.
And that's what I did. But, you know, the traffic in 20 years that I've been living in Los Angeles, the traffic has gotten progressively worse. And the latest step I've taken in coping with that is devoting myself to taking public transportation. There's a small train system that I take advantage of. And there are all these different ways of getting around that are really quite cheap and efficient. But you have to be very resourceful and very careful in the way that you do it. And there are still days which are very frustrating. But I do manage. I teach at USC, and it takes me between 35 and 45 minutes to get there, which is not unreasonable. I mean, there are some people sitting in their cars for 2 hours.
At least.
So, well, I don't see that I'm, you know, doing anything that weird.
Right.
But,
I mean, you know, this is coming from somebody who doesn't own a car as well.
Yeah.
You know.
It's easier here.
Right.
I mean, you know, lots and lots of people do it here. In fact, lots of people do it in Los Angeles. But they tend to be people of color. They tend to be working class people. They tend to be people who are not making a choice so much as living in a certain social class or a certain situation that obliges them to not have a car. And with me, it's more of a choice. And that's the other thing. I see a side of Los Angeles that most people outside of the city are quite ignorant of. Now, these are the people who do the work.
They're riding the bus. Do you bring a camera with you?
I don't invade people's privacy on the bus. That is kind of a problem for me, ethically. But your whole experience of the city changes when you don't have a car to rely upon. Your range of motion is different. Your experience of the street is different. Your relationship to automobiles is different. And that is something I hope to represent in what I shoot. How this will mesh with the anatomy of melancholy, I'm not sure. But, you know, Burton himself had a relationship to academia, clearly. But a lot of his concerns were shockingly modern. You know, it was a world of ambition and corruption in which individuals felt powerless. It's not all that different than the United States we find ourselves in now. And that actually is my hope, that there will be this kind of collision that will enable people to see that this text, which was written in the 17th century, in a language quite different than what we speak, is in fact fresh, and there is something there for us to see, to learn. And it's a book I love. And, you know, you never tire of it because it's so big and so long and so varied in its contents. And he was an interesting guy. His sensibility was quite modern. He was a kind of connoisseur of filth, among other things. There are passages in the book that are vividly imagined perversity.
That he wrote,
yeah. And they're very modern in their sensibility. This combination of refinement and degradation is something that I think modern spectators and modern readers can appreciate. And it's certainly something I'm interested in my work. That sounds like a final comment, doesn't it?
Well, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Anything else you want to ask me on a factual level? Is there anything else we need to get on the flashcard?
We should, you know, definitely give a last plug for your film.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So if you would.
VO, Film Montages for Peter Rohr, and More British Sounds are showing at the Pacific Film Archive, 2575 Bancroft Way, Berkeley. And it's Tuesday, February 20th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are between $4 and $8. So it's a nice,
a
cheap show. Yes.
Bring a date.
And yes, if you have any questions, call 510-642-0808. Thank you.
My name is Zephyr. You're listening to NPR. The show is called Frank Prattle, and we've been live with William E. Jones. He shared with us many things all across the board, from 17th century naughtiness, what have you, all the way to modern day filth as well. And Los Angeles without a car. That's quite impressive, William. Thank you so much.
Thank you.